Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
Afternoon, Washington, D.C., Maryland, Virginia, wherever you are tuned in, you are listening to Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. As always, we want to thank you for your listenership and for your support. It really does mean a lot. Today, I'm honored to have on Regina Harmon. She is the executive director of the Food Recovery Network, a great organization making sure that people are fed, are being taken care of. And we're going to talk today about the organization, the work that they do, how you can get involved, and how you can support. So welcome so much, Regina. Thank you so much for joining us here on Taking Action.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Wonderful. You know, before I always like to ask our guests to give us a personal introduction and just a little bit about yourself so folks know who they're listening to.
Yes. So I'm Regina. So wonderful to meet everyone who's listening in. I am such a fan of this program, of the radio station. So I hail from New England. I'm a New Englander by birth. I grew up in New England and lived for a really long time in Pittsburgh before moving to DC in 2011. And I actually grew up in a working poor household. So from that household, I was able to get, you know, my really strong work ethic. You know, I think also just like living in the United States, we all understand that grind culture. And, you know, along the way to help me get up and through being a working poor adult, once I, you know, left the home of my parents, a lot of people helped me along the way, helped guide me, help open doors of opportunity for me as I gained my education and the power of education to become the person I am now, who has dedicated my career and my life to helping others so that they too can become the full people that they are supposed to be. And, you know, we can do that when we alleviate poverty, when we help ensure people have access to resources. Some really beautiful things can happen for all of us. So great to be here. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. Why don't we start out, just let's give folks an understanding of what the Food Recovery Network does. I'd like to get a little into the history, or, you know, how you all came to be. But in general, what is the work of the Food Recovery Network?
Yes, we were started in 2011 by college students at the University of Maryland. And even before we became a national nonprofit, the students at the University of Maryland began collecting surplus food from their dining hall at UMD. And they did that because, you know, for many of us who have the pleasure, the privilege of going to higher education, in their unique ecosystem in academia, they were learning a lot about the global world. But they were specifically learning a lot about pretty big societal problems. So they were learning about the global environmental crisis, learning about poverty, learning about war, and not a whole heck of a lot of solutions to those huge problems. And at the same time, because they had work study, a couple of them were working on their college dining hall and saw firsthand, you know, all this really wonderful food being thrown away. One of the co-founders, you know, played intramural ultimate frisbee. And, you know, he remembers very vividly, you know, running after practice to the dining hall and sometimes making it, sometimes not, literally being there at that moment when, you know, at 4:59 p.m., the food that they had for him to purchase was perfectly good to buy. But if he made it there at 5:02 p.m., they could not sell him that food. And that perfectly good food was then thrown away. So they saw that crisis, you know, of the food happening on their very campus. And then the third, you know, instance, so, you know, learning about these big problems, seeing food being thrown away. And the third thing is they were volunteering out in their community. And they were doing things like peanut butter and jelly sandwich making drives, volunteering at soup kitchens nearby. But they saw, so they saw the direct need in the College Park, Hyattsville area. They saw people suffering from food insecurity. But then they also went back a little bit of like, we have access to food that should not be thrown away, and access to what they were learning in academia, which is a lot of people are hungry right now. And we know that when we throw food away, that actually harms our environment. So they put all of those things together and began to recover all that wonderful surplus food from their dining halls. And what is so important about that particular moment was it actually, when the light bulbs clicked, that we see people who are hungry, why are we making all this food when we actually have food available that we could provide, really good food. When that light bulb went off, they went to their dining hall manager and said, hey, we have this idea. And it took a really long time for her to meet with them. She kind of pushed them off, said, I'm too busy. But the really important part here is that they didn't give up. They had that resiliency. They wanted to be heard, and they demanded that they were heard. And I think that's really so inspiring for me to hear that from these young people who were just, you know, hearing no from quote unquote an adult. You know, there's an age difference there. There was a power dynamic difference there. And when they finally were able to, you know, get their dining manager to hear them out, she said, you know what, that's actually a really good idea. And wow. She added to that her knowledge of how to handle food safely. And so within the first month of recovering surplus food and bringing it down to a church right down the street from where their campus was, they recovered a couple thousand pounds of food. And they then told their friends at different colleges and universities, hey, you should do the same thing. Here's how we did it. And that's how Food Recovery Network was born by the power of young people, grassroots, really trying to be that change. I know this is a phrase that we all know so much, you know, really trying to be the change you want to see in the world. And that's, you know, what the students at the University of Maryland did when they created Food Recovery Network.
Wow. And, you know, I think it's always important to unpack kind of the vocabulary. And you know, you're talking about food surplus. Could you kind of big picture, yes. Like, you know, in this country specifically, you know, there is a lot of food that to a large extent gets wasted, right? Mm-hmm. That could be used to feed. And we're seeing changes like through the Food Recovery Network, or, you know, I see ads like Odd Fruit or something, you know, the fruit that isn't nice enough, they're repackaging it and selling it again. But, you know, what that tells me is that there's a lot, there's a surplus, right? There's extra food out there that is being wasted that could go to feed people. Could you talk to us a little bit about that issue?
I'd love to. So we partner with a really great research institution called ReFed, and they're the organization that provides a lot of data for all of us. And in fact, the executive director of ReFed, the president now, Dana Gunders, was the food scientist who helped us all to get this statistic that maybe might sound familiar to some and maybe not as familiar to others, which is about 40% of the food that we produce in the United States is wasted. Now, also because of ReFed, they have been able to refine that because so many people and organizations like FRN, you know, once we realized what was really going on, you know, has changed some things to make that number a little bit better. But to put some context to that, when we think about 2022, about 38% of the food in our food supply system in the United States went unsold or uneaten. And that translates to about 235 million tons of food in one year. So this is happening year after year after year. And there have been some really wonderful strides, as you just pointed out, but we are growing, we are harvesting, we are transporting, we are stocking, we are purchasing, we are cooking all of this really wonderful food, and then it simply is not being eaten by humans. And this is still food that is edible to all of us. And so Food Recovery Network is trying to shift that process, that maddening process from wasting all of that food to recovering all of that, what we call surplus food. And there is extra surplus food at every single point within the food system.
Wow. Any thoughts or insights as to like why does that food get wasted? Like what is causing that food to say, these 235 million tons, and I realize that probably changes year to year, but what is the cause of that?
So, Food Recovery Network, we work from farm fields all the way up to the institution. So, grocery stores, civic centers, corporate dining, everything right up until our individual homes. But we do have some nice tips on how to, prevent food from going to waste at your individual home level. And so, when we think about that, at the farm level, for example, there is surplus food because farmers are growing all this precious food, all the raw produce that is so important to all of us. And that food sometimes becomes surplus when they don't have a contract to buy the food or a contract gets canceled, like we saw so prevalently during COVID. Contracts for all these blueberries, strawberries, lettuce, all canceled because restaurants, civic centers, you name it, just didn't need that food anymore. So that was a really terrible disservice that we did to all of our farmers. But sometimes, our farmers have really good deals. They're going to farm, they're farmers, they're going to grow food. So sometimes there is an abundance to the abundance that causes surplus food. A lot of times, Food Recovery Network, for example, we are working on supporting the Food Date Labeling Act, which helps us to federally standardize food labels. So about 80% of homes are going to throw food away that's still really good because people are confused by the date label. Now, how does that affect, everywhere else besides, our individual homes? Well, what that means is food is being pulled from the shelves unnecessarily. It's still safe, the quality is still high, but because of these dates, food is being pulled from the shelves, and that food actually cannot be donated to food banks, soup kitchens, places like that because of this arbitrary date. That doesn't, again, necessarily mean this food isn't safe to eat. It is just a way that tells manufacturers or grocery stores, like, hey, we need to put in, fresh stock. So tons and tons and tons of food is being wasted because of that. And then also, yeah, things like labeling changes. If we think about an event for 5,000 people, how many of those people are going to eat the food, not show up? It's just a numbers game sometimes in terms of we over order because we don't want people to not have, a full offering of the meals that we've provided. A lot of contracts at these kinds of events, if say 5,000 people are going to show up, they will actually say you have to make six enough food for 6,000 people, already more than who's scheduled to be there. And then we know there's some attrition, and people don't show up or they just don't want to have the meal. So there's surplus in that way as well. And that is what we typically would consider, this prepared food. So Food Recovery Network, we are experts in recovering raw produce all the way up to things that have already been prepared so we can keep that food safe to bring it locally to wherever, locations can handle that food safely as well.
Wow, thank you for that. I'm gonna have to, I have two daughters. I'm gonna have to show them the website so we can see how to not, keep stuff out here. I just saw them throw something away and I was like, why are you girls throwing that away?
Happy to
I'm
talk to
like, you
them at
don't pay
any
for
time.
that. No, thank you for that explanation because I think that's really
Absolutely.
important. Now, the other side of that I heard you mention a little earlier is like, if this stuff, this food rather, goes unused, it has an environmental impact, I would imagine, right? Like, because it just becomes stuff that has to get put somewhere. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's such an important underbelly of, this beautiful process. In the United States, we make some really gorgeous food. And right now, the system is geared towards if there's no quote unquote use for that food, the number one place that food goes is into landfill. It's really sad. And again, I'm so thankful for the work of Food Recovery Network and others in the food recovery space to say we have to stop doing that. So the number one item in our landfills all across the United States is food. And globally, when we pan back globally, food waste is the third largest contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. The number one contributor is the United States. The number two contributor is China. The number three contributor is food waste. So I always say if we, the United States, as the number one contributor, tackle the number three contributor, food waste, we would be, double timing, changing this process. So when food goes into landfill, now we're transporting all of this precious food into landfill. So we're using the gas that it takes to do the labor, all these big trucks, bringing all of this precious food to landfill. Now it'll go into landfill and it will rot eventually. And as it rots, it releases methane, it releases CO2. And all of that extra greenhouse gases are being, you know, driven into our atmosphere and causing what we now know to be climate change. Those gases, those warmed up gases that are super high energy, are settling up above in our atmosphere. So when the sun's rays come down, you know, they hit the ground, bounce back up, but they're being blocked from leaving our atmosphere because we have all of this extra greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. So that's what happens when we throw food away. But also, you know, really importantly, within that, there's also then all the water it takes. 23% of our drinkable water goes into growing crops, transporting crops, cooking crops that we are then going to throw away. So places that are seeing some of these real climate issues, when we think about our desert communities, when we think about California, we're wasting all of this precious water. We cannot waste water in this way anymore. So that's why we must, the immediacy of now, to help our environment and to help those struggling with food insecurity, means we must begin to make food recovery the norm so we can stop that maddening cycle.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for that. And, you know, I'm going to get on my soapbox, you know, like, you know, often you'll hear like politicians saying, you know, we shouldn't fund school lunches or and they're saying, you know, oh, people should have the money. We have all of this food that is literally going to waste. So, oh, God, it is maddening. But on that note, I know you all have, you know, several initiatives to connect people to the food, you know, recovery, to distributing food. Could you talk to us? I know you all have like, I have my notes here open and I should have kept it right on the titles. You have community fridges, you do an elementary school food distribution. I want to talk to you about some of your advocacy, but talk to us a little bit about some of those initiatives, how you connect folks with the food actually.
Thank you so much. We're really proud of these initiatives that we are seeing such beautiful impact, meaning, you know, we're able to help support thousands of people that are experiencing food insecurity. And that just means they're hungry. You know, food insecurity is a technical term, but it means people are hungry and they should not have to deal with that at all. So in 2020, you know, Food Recovery Network had been around for about a decade. And I started in 2015. So I, you know, inherited this really wonderful budding movement. So, you know, right around that time, 2020, we'll go back, you know, with love and with respect, because it's a hard time. COVID was raging, the murder of George Floyd was happening, people were rising up and continued to rise up for injustices that they were seeing, including, you know, just continued denial, extraction from particular communities, you know, just the struggle that people were facing. And so for Food Recovery Network, you know, during that time, we were thinking about, okay, we've been able to do so much organically. You know, students self-identify. We had, you know, hundreds of you know, chapters. Sorry, my dog's probably about to bark. The mailman is here, the mail person. So at that time, you know, we were around for about 10 years and students were self-selecting organically. We had a couple hundred chapters across the United States, and we wanted to really understand our abilities to feed more people faster. So we know that the chapter model works. So we were thinking, okay, what is it that we can do? So we collected all of this disaggregated data. Now, what I mean by that is we collected the US Census data, we collected SNAP enrollment, we collected data on race and ethnicity. We worked with the MIT Living Wage Center to understand, you know, where in the United States are there a few things that we know to be true. The highest rates of food insecurity, where are those places? But also within those places, where is there the most surplus food? And within those instances, where is the latent capacity that Food Recovery Network has relied on over these last 10 years. So for us, higher education. Those were, and then for us, with our framework that we call FRN10X, we have at the very center of how we do our work, the responsibility to close and mitigate ethnic and racial disparities. So where were those locations? And we were able to identify one county across all of the 50 states in the United States, knowing hungers in every single zip code. Our chapter model can help get into all of those zip codes. But for Food Recovery Network, what programming can we develop that is going to feed more people faster? So as you said, within that, that's the onus that we put on ourselves to feed more people faster. And so we began to, with respect and with love to the communities that we had identified, we provided these offerings, and we had the funding. So we fund our programming before we go into a community to say, you know, here's a great idea. You only need $60,000. Mm-hmm. No, we don't want to extract upon these communities. So from there, we were able to pilot some really amazing programming that's feeding more people faster. So as you said, you know, one of these programs is our free fresh produce distribution markets that started actually in Atlanta. That's where we first began to pilot that. And then from there, we replicated in Baltimore and we replicated in the St. Paul area. And those markets are still going on to this day. And as we were doing those programming to say like, okay, with these fresh produce markets, what do the community, what are they telling us that they need? So we worked with Title I schools. So these are schools, elementary schools, that, you know, the majority of students who go there are eligible for free and reduced lunch. Now, as I think you were indicating, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, this should just be free.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, a little kid all the way up to, you know, high school, you should just have free food. I don't care how much money your guardians make. We have enough for all of you to not even have to worry about who's paying for what. We can provide that to our young people. But here we are. So we work with Title I schools where that majority is eligible. And then also about 50% of the students who go there are walkers. They walk home to and from school. So that we would be able to then very specifically work with the community to say, okay, when we have this fresh produce market, when should we have it? Okay, Wednesdays after school, because that's when soccer practice happens. And that's when we get like the biggest bulk of students after school and parents coming. And we're able to provide the most produce. And it's those kinds of details that kind of, you know, you should have the market here, this specific location near our school, that we're able to move tens of thousands of pounds of fresh produce. And then as you'd mentioned, the refrigerator program grew out of that when we actually went into the St. Paul area. So in Atlanta, the food at the produce markets just went. And in Baltimore, the food was just gone. But because of some of the locations that we were in St. Paul, we actually had surplus to the surplus. And we were able to create these refrigerator programs. And we do have this in Atlanta because there had been instances of surplus to the surplus, as I say. And so this meant having refrigerators at the schools where we could fill those refrigerators with the fresh produce from the markets. And then the teachers were able to say, you know, teachers had access to that. Students could come depending on where the refrigerators were and access that fresh produce and bring it home with them. And in Arlington, Virginia, we have a refrigerator program that is in the lobby of a housing complex where families, and we're really proud of this, the families have maybe a voucher for their housing, but they don't necessarily have supports for the food that they deserve. So we just have a refrigerator in that lobby and we put in trays of food and the families are able to come down, grab those trays of food, bring it up to their apartment, and now they have food for their families that they can just warm up. And the whole part of this with the dignity and respect and working so specifically with the communities is we need to make this food easeful to access for the people who need it because they are booked and busy, working multiple jobs, trying to show up for their kids, you know, in these different ways that we all want to show up for our kids. So how can we make it easeful for them? Because they might not always be able to get over to a food bank. It might be too far away or it might be open on days that they have to work. So we really want to look at how we can make this access to the people easiest as possible.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I was really impressed when I was looking at your website, the kind of data-driven nature of making sure that people, that the food gets into people's hands. And, you know, we've had some experience during COVID. We did a lot of food distribution. And when we started, we're like, yeah, we'll show up and we'll offer people food. And we weren't taking in consideration. Like sometimes, you know, people aren't able to make it. So we had to like figure out like who else is in the neighborhood that we can get food to. So we make sure we're not, you know, wasting food. So you guys are doing that on a very large scale, which I think is really important, you know, to make sure that it gets to who needs it. Could you talk to us just because you guys are national, but on a local level, the kind of the what they call the DMV area, DC, Maryland, Virginia, talk to us about some of the chapters that exist in this area.
We are so proud of the different chapters that we have here in the DMV, and we still have our flagship chapter at the University of Maryland, and they've been able to recover. I think at this point, it's upwards of like 280,000 pounds of food. Don't quote me on that. We have all the specifics, but I'm just, you know, it is such an enormous amount of food that they've been able to recover over, you know, since 2011 and a little bit even before that. And this is the dedication, you know, that this is year over year over year, one carload of food at a time that we've been able to see. We have chapters here in the DC area, George Mason, Georgetown Law, American. And we want to be able to, you know, have an FRN chapter across all higher education, you know, campuses, because you know they just have a lot of food. So really we can get into all those different capillaries, you know, within the veins and the arteries of, you know, the United States. And a lot of our students, you know, when we think about our DMV, you know, they recover surplus food and then they donate that food off campus. So University of Maryland, they started off recovering food at a church down the street. And I actually just had a conversation yesterday with Pastor Ben, who is the pastor of that church. And we were just, you know, reminiscing about this beautiful partnership well over a decade now. And he was one of the very first people I met, you know, when I came on the Food Recovery Network almost 10 years ago. So the relationships are just so precious. Because this is how we get to understand the needs of our community. And when we are involved in our communities, as we all know, it changes us too. You know, it gives us skin in the game. And so our students in the DMV area are recovering food, bringing it off campus. But a lot of students, their chapters will take the food and keep it on campus to address student food insecurity on their campus because our student leaders want to make sure that they're student body, that their fellow students have access to the food that they deserve too. So we'll see that as well. But truly, what we see in this area, and it's reflective of, you know, the 205 chapters we have across the United States, the students really care about making sure we have what we need to thrive. And we also see some of our chapters become very involved in advocacy. They're very involved in education because a lot of times when I was talking about we are a well-oiled machine to throw food away when we no longer want it. We disregard the value, we disregard the human labor that it took to grow it, you know, our incredible farmers, the farmhands, the truck drivers. You know, my uncle's a truck driver. He doesn't transport food, but still, you know, the food mostly gets to us by truck and by boat and by train. We disregard all of that love and respect for our jobs when we throw this food away. And so our students do a lot of education to say, hey, there's federal policy in place that says we can actually recover this food. We don't have to throw it away. Hey, pilot this out, try it. We've tried it. You can do it too. If you just find the right people, like the co-founders who started FRN, if you just find the right people who are willing to say yes, then you can do almost anything. Sometimes you have to bug them a little bit and show them the way, but our students are doing that every single day. And it's again a huge reason why I'm just so inspired to be part of Food Recovery Network in this movement.
Yeah, wow. No, that is great. Folks, you are tuned into Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM. We are joined this afternoon by Regina Harmon. She's the executive director of the Food Recovery Network. We've been talking about the work that they do to make sure that surplus food here in this country gets in the hands and the bellies and the tummies of people that need it. If you have any questions, any comments, please feel free to give us a call, 202-588-0893. Regina, before we get any further, could you give us, how can folks connect? How can folks find out more about the Food Recovery Network if they want to volunteer? I know a lot of students listen, to our show. How can folks get involved, in the myriad of ways that you guys, do this work?
Thank you so much for that. And for everyone listening and your network of people who aren't listening, but I hope you spread the word, all are welcomed. All are invited to be involved with this. And there's lots of different ways. And so people can make the choices for them, whichever way makes the most sense. So if you are a student on higher ed, we would love for you to start a chapter. Just takes a couple of friends, and we have all the resources you could need to start a chapter. If your higher ed campus already has a chapter, we would love to introduce you to the students who are involved in that chapter. They are awesome people. I've had the chance to meet hundreds of students in this movement, and they are just really incredible people. So starting a chapter is a great way to be involved. For everyone listening in, you have heard me talk about these locations, at the farm fields, yes, but corporate dining, large scale events. Like, we recover from the Super Bowl tailgate parties. In fact, we travel around with the Super Bowl and we recover from large scale events. If you have a conference, an event that has 2000 plus people, we would love to help set up a recovery plan in place. And we have some capacities to actually be on the ground, no matter where these locations are, to support direct food recovery. So if you're places of interest that have food for whatever reason, whether it's corporate dining or because it's an event, we must make sure that there's a food recovery plan in place. So you can get in touch with us. And by helping to start a food recovery plan, just by making that connection, you can really make an immediate impact in your local community. So I would love for people to get in touch with us if they have some direct connections they want to make where there might be food. We always appreciate when people have it in their budgets to financially donate to FRN. That helps us to go to the places that we need to go. So we show up to St. Paul, we're in Atlanta, we go to Baltimore, we go to other locations to help ensure food recovery is happening. Financial support ensures we have that flexibility, that we can replicate these programs. Like I said, we're gonna go and replicate even further, but we have to have that funding in place before we even begin that work. That's a really wonderful way to be involved as well. And then please, anyone who's listening, go to our website, go to our social media. If you want a dose of inspiration, we have all kinds of pictures of our students in action, taking action. And it's really so inspiring to see this. So if you want to just begin to learn more, we have a really robust blog post. There's tons of videos. So if you are someone who wants to continue to understand and wrap your mind around the scale of the problem that we are facing, I definitely welcome people to visit our website. And then, send us an email if you have questions or if there's other ideas that I haven't mentioned. A lot of times people want to help with an actual food recovery. And then I tell them, that's great. We do at the Gaylord, not too far, in Maryland, we do recovery there a couple of times a week. And it's usually at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and people are like, oh, I have work to do on that day. And we say, thank you so much. This is why college students are such incredible, valuable people within the community to do this, because they happen to be around, Wednesdays at 3:10 PM, Fridays at 10:30 at night. Mm-hmm. Their schedules just aren't that 9 to 5, food availability isn't 9 to 5. And so it's a little bit harder for people to come and do a recovery with us, because also to move thousands of pounds of food, you only actually need a couple of people. We're really, really good at this. So, you might've wondered, Regina, why aren't you offering that as a way for people to be involved? But that's typically why. It's not something that people have found really fits into their daily schedules. But we also have volunteer opportunities virtually that we call our power hours. And so I definitely invite people to check that out. And that's a really great way. And you don't have to lift anything heavy to be part of that. And so I think that's another really great way for people to be involved. So again, if anyone hearing all of this, please hear the invitation in what I'm saying. And if something hasn't struck you as a way you want to be involved, be in touch, because we know that we can do so much more.
Yeah. And that's foodrecoverynetwork.org. Is a website to visit. A lot of information. I know I mentioned, really impressed by the breadth of work and the way you guys have documented all of that. So make sure to check that out so you can get involved. I wanted to touch upon a little bit around your advocacy, given, you know, there's quite a bit happening in the political space. We're all hearing and seeing and at least personally, very concerned about what's happening. Can you talk to us some about, you know, what you guys are keeping your eyes on? But you had mentioned you are trying to push forward an act or a bill. Talk to us a little bit about the advocacy work that you all are engaging in that pushes your work forward.
Yes. Thank you so much for that. And I have a few things to say about our advocacy, in particular because of the time in which we are all living that you mentioned. And for a lot of us, it's difficult. It's really hard to see people around us maybe losing their jobs, people who are trying to access higher education get their funding taken away. There's a lot of things that every day people are experiencing. And that was happening, 4 years ago, that was happening 8 years ago, that was happening 12 years ago, 25 years ago, on and on and on. We were all born into food insecurity. And that's a policy decision, and so one of the beautiful things that I love about Food Recovery Network is it helps us to really think about what is in the scope of our control. The students at the University of Maryland said, hey, we can feed people in our direct community. They wanted, of course, to feed everyone. And that's what we said. Let's recover surplus food to feed everyone who is hungry in the United States. Where are we going to start? So for us, it was starting with programming that will feed people faster, just immediately. For the students, though, in 2011, it was, we can feed people in our community down the street. And then you get more chapters that are feeding people down the street or on their exact campus. So we really have to, hone in on the fact that when we take action, you know what we're doing? We're taking action. We are improving things. So there is that piece. And then my next concentric circle within that is for Food Recovery Network around our advocacy. Sometimes, and Dr. King tells us this about the promised land, he may not get there with us.
That's right.
It is, it's a long journey sometimes to correct some of the wrongs that we know morally need to be corrected. And hunger is one of those things that must be corrected. And older than us, and maybe I hope in my lifetime I see that ended and ended forever. But some of these things take time, and we see beautiful successes along the way as we tarry towards the end goal, whatever that goal might be for you. So for us, this is a very ongoing issue that we are contributing and improving. So within our advocacy, part of that is we advocate for a living wage for everyone. Mm. Now, no matter who has been in office, that has not really been the case. And there isn't a whole heck of a lot of appetite for increasing our federal minimum wage, which is embarrassing in its harmful. We haven't seen a lot of appetite for increasing that wage to a living wage. We have often seen across whomever is, in office, the suppression of work and the labeling of some work as unskilled or whatever it might be. These are all tactics to ensure that we suppress how much we pay people. And so for Food Recovery Network, the number one way people get their food is they buy it. But you can't buy your food if your rent is so high, or if your medical bills are so high, or your childcare, your transportation. A living wage means we have enough money to buy all of the things that we need. So we advocate for a living wage, no matter who's in office. And then in from there, we, advocated for the canceling of college student debt, because it is dramatically impairing our economy. People are not fulfilling their whole lives. They are being hampered by this incredible debt when they were just trying to, in the pathway that we've always said, this is the way to get to, all the things that you might need, economic security. But for so many people, that has not been the case. So just in the act of trying to gain their education, they have been saddled with an enormous amount of college debt. And we can talk about why college is so expensive. You know, when we think about when we moved from, not very many people going on to higher education, it was mostly white people that had access to higher education, to opening that up to other people. And we have to change the tactics to maintain that hierarchy. So now here we are, however many years later. So we advocated for that. And then most immediately, as I had indicated before, we advocate for the Food Date Labeling Act. And this is, now we're still, no matter who's in office, I'm going to go to the Hill and educate folks. Every single zip code has food insecurity. Billions of dollars are wasted every single year because people in their homes and across grocery stores and during transportation are throwing food away unnecessarily. And so we ask for two federally designated labels. One is a quality date indicator. The other is a safety. So one is, we want two labels. And the Harvard Food Law and Policy Clinic, they're incredible. Also really great resources within this space, have provided, surveys for consumers, to help think through what is confusing to you, what's not confusing to you. And so two indicators were the ones that made the most sense to everyday consumers. Best if used by, that is our quality indication. Like, okay, you can still eat this. Maybe it might, taste it a little bit, but you're gonna be okay. And then it's used by, and that's the safety. If you haven't used it by this date, you must discard it. Hopefully you're gonna compost it. Hopefully you're gonna, we don't have to put it into landfill. But we are, we want to support the Food Date Labeling Act because here's the beautiful thing. To do this, there are already businesses within industry. So think like the Walmarts of the world. There are already some folks that, that handle mass volumes of food that are already doing this. So industry is like, great, we can do this, not a problem. And I just learned this recently because I am going out to the Hill and I'm asking people all these newbie questions. What does this mean? What does that mean? To change this, to federally standardize these date labels, it would cost the United States $0. So we're not asking for any money to change this because, food is being consumed, it's being thrown away all the time. So that bag of spinach, as soon as it gets bagged up, you can actually put the quality indicators, the safety indicators on it today. And so there's a lot of reasons why it saves individual consumers tons of money. Billions. It saves, food banks can now accept food that they were no longer able to accept before. So we're able to increase how much food they have. It keeps food on shelves longer because we know it's not unsafe to eat. And so we want to advocate for the Food Date Labeling Act. We have more information about that on our website. And, because as I was talking, this long arc, of work, there was success. And that was called the Food Donation Improvement Act of 2023. And that expanded upon the 1996 law, the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan law, that says if you donate food in good faith, you can't be held liable. And that liability scare is what prevents a lot. And what I've seen over the years that I've been doing this work, liability is what prevents a lot of locations from actually recovering and donating their food. They're afraid to get sued. So they just don't. And we really need to educate people that, you really can, no matter who's in office, the federal level, we want people to recover food and donate food. It is the most cost-effective thing we can do with food. When we throw it away, you might not see it directly, but within all these indirect costs, it is actually quite expensive to throw food away. So let's keep that value, as I was mentioning before, the value of the food every moment within the food system, and recover that food and donate it.
Wow. You know, as I hear you speak, you know, I just want to make sure folks understand, like, there's such value to like the immediate work that you do, right? Like the getting food into people's hands, so they don't have to experience hunger. But a lot of this work is helping to change the values, right? Or at least it's pushing to change the values of this country that say, like you said, right? As soon as we see that expiration date, this has no value anymore. It's trash, right? Like for a lot of people, they consider literal trash that has no value. And unfortunately, that replicates itself in other segments of our society. So really, kudos to you, to the Food Recovery Network for you know pushing that envelope to make sure that you know that this work is having an impact on multiple levels. So really, really great. And that leads me into my kind of wrap up question as we begin to wrap up. I was hoping that you could share with us maybe two stories, one around how have you personally seen the work that you all do impact students that are involved? And you alluded to a little bit about that. It makes them think a little bigger, but a little more globally. But then also, if you could share with us a little bit about the impact you've seen it had on a family or an individual that was food insecure, that needed that help. I don't know if you have that's putting you on the spot, but if you could share anything to that effect, that would be great.
I would love to. I just started having some dedicated interviews with some of our alums, really incredible people who maybe have graduated a couple of years ago, several years ago, and even before that, just hearing some of these awesome stories. Our alums are just incredible, and I've seen so many things over the years. I have seen people change their majors because they understand their purpose a bit better. And we have seen students specifically look for grad school opportunities where there is a Food Recovery Network chapter. We have been parts of students' PhD research. We have seen students graduate and become the heads of food pantries within their communities. We have seen so much change and growth from our student alums. It is just incredible. And actually, we partner with the Congressional Hunger Center. They host every year in the summer a Hill Day, where they bring students from all over the United States to go to the Hill and have meetings with their elected officials, or any either from their actual home states or districts or close by. And we always invite some of our FRN students to do that work as well, so that they can learn how to best and better use their voice. Because again, these are leaders. They were leaders before they came to FRN, and they are coming here because they know that they can, do something and want to be part of something. And through that, they get to practice at this and get better and better and better. So by the time they get to the Hill, sure, it might be the first time that they've actually spoken directly with an elected official or a staffer, but let me tell you, they've probably had to advocate for change on their college campus before and have conversations with a new dining manager who doesn't know that this chapter has been recovering food for the past 3 years. And like now they kind of want to stop that. And oh no, we cannot do that. We have to keep recovering food. So I have seen some really incredible people. I know some really incredible people. And as that relates to the families, the incredible families that should not be experiencing food insecurity in the United States. Our food, the students recover, that we recover from large scale events, that we recover from the Gaylord, the convention centers. We bring that food directly to what we call hunger fighting nonprofit partner agencies. So these are the food banks, these are the soup kitchens, these are the churches, these are the domestic violence shelters. These are the after school programs. There are so many different places all around our communities that actually provide meals to people, whether they have a shared meal or they collect the food into boxes for families to take with them. We see it in all kinds of different methods, and it's a beautiful thing. And so we also know that when these incredible nonprofits can rely on the food, now sure, it's probably not 100% of the food that they need. Some of these locations serve 800 meals a day, 1,000 meals a day. It's really pretty incredible. But when they can consistently rely on the food that we are able to provide to them, they can make other decisions within their budgets. And that's an incredible thing, especially because of the cost of the food these days. So we don't always necessarily directly engage with the recipients of the food. We do at our distribution markets, but again, we're not asking any questions. You are all welcome. Come in, try some of this broccoli, try these apples, and look at that weird looking onion. Have you ever had one of those before? Let's try it. But when we were in New Orleans, recovering from the celebrity tailgate parties at the Super Bowl, we recovered food and brought it to this really incredible local nonprofit called New Orleans Mission. And the dining manager there, because they serve hundreds of meals a day, like so many. They are a really important nonprofit within their community. When asked about the food that we were able to donate and bring to them, he said, you know what? There was pallets of butter. There was, you know, cartons and cartons of heavy cream. We can't afford this on our own. And so while we have this food that Efren has been able to recover and bring to us, we have been able to increase the quality of what we can provide to everyone who comes to us in need of meals that they deserve. And I just think about that, you know, this food has probably already been consumed by now, but that could be happening for them every single day.
No.
So we have all kinds of stories like that, you know, every single day. Food recovery is happening, and we just want to increase how much is happening every single day, the pace at which it's happening. So, you know, for everyone listening in, I hope that you look around you and you just see opportunity, because it is there, whether from us at Food Recovery Network or other things that you might be passionate about, particularly in this really hard time. You know, as Mr. Rogers reminds us, go to the helpers. Maybe you are a helper yourself, and let's keep that fabric of our community strong so we can help each other through up and through this difficult time.
No, that's 100% right. Do something. And it could be very small, and it could lead to, you know, huge, huge things.
Yes.
So I want to thank you, Regina, you know, so much for the work that you do, for the time you spent with us this afternoon. I want to encourage folks, you know, who want to find out more, please go check out the Food Recovery Network's website. That's just foodrecoverynetwork.org. I know you'll learn a lot. You can connect with their social media through their website as well. And yeah, just thank you so, so much. We hope to have you back in the future just to check in on you all and see how you're doing. Anything new, you know, always feel free to join us. But thank you. Thank you so much for the work you do. All the folks, you know, that you work with, we want to send a big shout out and a thank you and just continued success.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so wonderful talking with you. I feel so energized. As I said, I love the show, and I am just going to take all this with me into the rest of my day and the rest of my week. So thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. And let me tell the WPFW listeners, when we were emailing back and forth, she said, I listened to the show. I love the station. So thank you so much. You know, folks are out there listening that are doing this wonderful work, right? So thank you all so much for tuning in. We will catch you next Tuesday. Stay tuned for the news in just a couple of minutes. And then right after that, you've got Democracy. Why do I always mess up on that name? Just following here after the news, I got all caught up. But make sure to stay tuned here at the WPFW, and we will catch you next Tuesday. Peace, everyone.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Last week, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused the United States of launching a, quote, trade war against the country due to the threat of tariffs. This trade war between the United States and Canada has now escalated as President Trump announced today that he will double his planned tariffs on steel and aluminum from 25% to 50% for Canada. Trump said on social media that the increase of the tariffs is set to take effect tomorrow in response to the price increases that the provincial government of Ontario, Canada, put on electricity that sold to the United States. However, Trump is still calling for the country of Canada to become the 51st state of America as a solution to the tariff situation. This is seen as a form of taunting that has infuriated Canadian leaders. This month marks 5 years since the COVID-19 pandemic broke out. And now the program that provided American households with free at-home COVID tests from the government has ended. According to the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, or ASPR, the website covidtests.gov is no longer accepting orders. Tests that were ordered before 8 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, March the 9th, will be shipped. Since the program began in 2021, more than 900 million free COVID tests have been mailed directly to U.S. households, and another 900 million tests were distributed to community centers, such as libraries, long-term care facilities, and food banks. On the website, covidtests.gov, ASPR stated that at-home COVID tests are sold at pharmacies, grocery stores, and many other retailers nationwide. A pack of two rapid at-home test kits cost around $12 to $24 out of pocket, but some brands may cost more. Meanwhile, PCR COVID tests can cost more depending on insurance coverage. If you've ever flown on Southwest Airlines, you may recall that you did not have to pay to check your first two bags. The airline even boasts the slogan, "Bags Fly Free." As a matter of fact, Southwest has always offered free checked bags since the airline started about 60 years ago, and it kept the policy in place even when its competitors started adding and increasing fees. Bob Jordan, the CEO of Southwest Airlines, noted previously that the lack of fees for the first two bags is cited as the number one reason in terms of why customers choose Southwest. However, all of that is about to change. Southwest Airlines announced today that they will begin charging for the first and second checked bag beginning on May 28th. The only travelers who will be exempt from these fees will be members of Southwest's A-List loyalty program, holders of its branded credit card, or those who are traveling on a business fare. Addressing the new fees, Bob Jordan now says the purpose of them is to return to the levels of profitability that both Southwest and their shareholders expect. To the D.C. area, in June of 2020, a pedestrian zone where people gathered to protest the murder of George Floyd was renamed Black Lives Matter Plaza, dedicated to Floyd's memory. The plaza included a mural with the words Black Lives Matter written in 50-foot bright yellow letters covering two blocks of 16th Street Northwest, which is north of the White House. This week, work began to paint over that Black Lives Matter mural. Its fate had been in question since Trump returned to the White House, and last week, Mayor Bowser said that the mural would be removed. Her announcement came shortly after Representative Andrew Clyde, a Republican from Georgia, introduced legislation threatening to withhold millions of federal funds from D.C. unless it painted over the words Black Lives Matter and renamed the area Liberty Plaza. In today's weather, it's currently about 70 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe. And thank you for listening.
Wondering how to get WPFW swag in your life?